The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Mike DeBaradinas. I'm the Managing Director for the City of Philadelphia. So tonight is a special night here at the Free Library. We have with us award-winning journalist Juan Gonzalez. Since the 70s, he has worked as a reporter, a columnist, and a commentator in newspapers, on the radio, and on television, becoming the first Latino journalist to be inducted into New York Journalism's Hall of Fame. So just a little aside here. I really wanted to be here tonight because I know Juan pretty well, at least from the old days. He's not only an author, a thoughtful author, sort of a well-read intellectual of sorts. When we were younger, we were organizing in Eastern North Philadelphia. He was the vice president of the Puerto Rican Alliance, and I was the director of the Kensington Joint Action Council. And these were both grassroots organizations dedicated to fighting for the rights and equity and fairness for the neighborhoods in that part of the city. And I will tell you, Juan was a principled, is and was a principled leader, a guy who got the theory of politics and the theory of change, but also deeply understood the importance of sort of fair housing, equal education, and equal job opportunity. So I'm really honored to be here with him tonight and to be introducing him to all of you. He is the author of Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. He founded the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. He has twice won the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and received the Hispanic Academy of Media Arts and Sciences Lifetime Achievement Award. He is the co-host of Democracy Now! And serves as a professor of professional practice in journalism and media studies at Rutgers University. His new book, Reclaiming Gotham, Bill de Blasio and the Movement to End America's Tale of Two Cities, argues that Bill de Blasio's landslide mayoral victory was a mandate for a more populist, less corporate New York. The Nation magazine calls Mr. Gonzalez our ablest chronicler of urban affairs, and his new work, the essential book on today's America's politics, and more importantly, on the next American politics. His talk will be in conversation with Democracy Now! Co-host Nermin Shika, author of The Present as History, Critical Perspectives on Global Power. We are pleased to have them here with us this evening. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Juan and Nermin to the Free Library.
Well, good evening all. I'm delighted to be in conversation with Juan. As you all probably know, we work together, but because we host on different days, we never meet. So it's really a pleasure. Thank you. It's a pleasure for me to be here in conversation with him about his really extraordinary book. And as Mike said in the introduction, Juan is a chronicler of urban affairs, as The Nation cited him as. And this book is not just about Bill de Blasio's rise to power as the mayor of New York City, although it is, of course, also about that. But it seems to me, Juan, that it's about much more than that. It's a book really about urban America and the kinds of transformations that we see in New York with Bill de Blasio, but also in other cities. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, thanks, and good evening to everyone. Thanks to Nermeen for agreeing to host this conversation with me. And I have to say, you know, Philly is my second home. I lived here for 15 years. I raised two of my children here. I have grandchildren here. So it's great to be back in Philly. I worked for the Philadelphia Daily News for 9 years and have fond memories of this great city. What I began to realize in 2013, which is when Bill de Blasio, this former leftist organizer and radical who had been worked in solidarity movements for the Sandinista government of Nicaragua, and at the same time worked as a political operative, and then became a city councilman and a public advocate and ran for mayor in 2013 and was considered the least likely to succeed of the various candidates that were running. And he somehow pulled off not only a surprise victory in the Democratic primary, but a landslide in the general election in November of 2013. That in and of itself would have been significant, if only because New York City is, after all, the most influential city in America. It is the center of the world financial system. It employs 300,000 people directly. 300,000 direct employees of the city of New York, and had a budget when de Blasio took office of a little bit north of $70 billion. It's about $85 billion today. So this is a huge shock to the elite of the nation's biggest city for a progressive and a former radical to become the mayor. But on the same day that Bill de Blasio was elected mayor of New York, a young maverick councilman who had been fighting the Democratic Party establishment for years in Pittsburgh by the name of Bill Peduto was elected the mayor of Pittsburgh. Along similar programs, de Blasio was calling income inequality the moral issue of our time and promised to do everything possible to begin to eradicate income inequality in New York. That's why he called New York a tale of two cities. But on the same day that de Blasio gets elected, Bill Peduto gets elected. On the same day that they get elected in Minneapolis, a young woman who was the head of a large nonprofit who had campaigned against public subsidies for the Minnesota Vikings football team and made a name for herself as campaigning against sports teams holding up their local governments, Betsy Hodges gets elected the mayor of Minneapolis. On the same day that they got elected, in Boston, a labor leader, a union leader by the name of Martin Walsh, cobbles together an alliance of African Americans and Latinos and labor unions to become the first labor leader elected mayor of Boston. On the same day, in November of 2013, a guy by the name of Ed Murray, a progressive state senator in Washington State, runs and gets elected the mayor of Seattle, promising to support $15 an hour as a minimum wage for the city of Seattle. A few months before all of them got elected, in Jackson, Mississippi, the most radical of them all, Chokwe Lumumba, former leader of the Republic of New Africa, an avowed black revolutionary, runs for and is elected the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi, the capital of Mississippi in the deepest part of the South. And then a few months later, in early 2014, another African-American radical, Raz Baraka, runs for and is elected the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, the former son of Amiri Baraka, the famous African-American poet and revolutionary. So all of these people got elected within months of each other in 2013. And, you know, we say in journalism that once is an incident, twice is a coincidence, three is a trend. I began to think something is happening. Why are all these people, all of whom were not expected to win, all of whom were talking about income inequality, police abuse, sustainable development, all suddenly winning elections? So I figured, let me take some time to look into this, to try to figure out what is happening. And the thrust of the book is that in the period after the Great Recession and after the Occupy Wall Street movement, the issue of income inequality became a burning question in not only the United States, but around the world. And one of the things I began to realize that this is an international phenomenon. In London, Sadiq Khan, the first Muslim ever to be elected mayor of a major city in England, is now the mayor of London. In Paris, Anne Hidalgo, a socialist and leading environmentalist, ran for and won election to the mayoralty of Paris. In Spain, a woman who led a whole movement of homeowners who, after the Great Recession and the mortgage meltdown in Spain, were all being evicted from their homes. She led a resistance movement against those evictions. Her name is Ada Colau, and she's now the mayor of Barcelona. And a woman that most people had never heard of, but which is mentioned in my book, Carmen Julín Cruz, the mayor of San Juan. Now everyone knows her name after the Hurricane Maria catastrophe in Puerto Rico and her standoffs, her repeated standoffs with President Trump. But Carmen Julín Cruz was elected in 2012 at the head of a progressive movement, not expected to win against her own party, and managed to be elected mayor and just was reelected in November of 2016. So the thrust of the book is that increasingly in the industrialized world, the national governments and the regional or state governments are being grabbed or controlled by right-wing conservative elements. But the cities are going in a completely different direction. The cities of the advanced industrial world are increasingly becoming more racially diverse, more reluctant to accept income inequality, more empowered by grassroots movements who are electing their own leaders now into office. And the cities are really the only hope for progressive change in the United States, in Europe, and other parts of the world. And so what I tried to do in this book is to chronicle what has happened. Not only what has happened, how did these people arise? What were the movements that brought them to power? What have they or have they not done? And what is the prospects for the future in terms of innovative, progressive uses of the leverage of local governments to begin to be able to affect change? So that's basically why I
Well, I mean, that's the thing. What I found very striking in reading Juan's book is because if you look at it from the outside, you know, people tend to emphasize much more, and especially, you know, having the head of state we now do, who obviously, you know, assumes a certain position on the world stage, it kind of completely eclipses everything else. So when you think of the U.S., you think of this person. But what your book brings out is the fact that what's happening in cities is so dramatically different, and not just in the U.S., but also, as you say, in France, in England, in Spain, and so on. So how do you explain why exactly the same features, the economic collapse, rising, and dramatic, staggering inequality at the local level lead to what you call a progressive resurgence, and at the national level produce, however one wants to characterize it, right-wing populism, et cetera, which is also true in the same countries where these mayors and city governments are more left-leaning?
Well, I think that there's a variety of reasons why the national and state governments are going in one direction and the cities are going in another. Clearly, there is the issue, especially in the United States, that rural areas in America have a disproportionate influence on national politics. I mean, when the state of Utah, which, I don't know, haven't looked lately, but if they're lucky, they got a million people in Utah, has the same number of U.S. senators as California, which is over 35 million and soon pressing on 40 million in population, there's something wrong with that picture. I mean, obviously, our federal nature of government means that the small states have a disproportionate influence on the national election results in terms of the Electoral College or in terms of members in the Senate. So you have the one the structural defects of American democracy, which have not been resolved and will be difficult to overcome. Two is the gerrymandered districts in places like Texas and other parts of the United States, where rural areas once again are prejudiced in terms of their voting population, not only in terms of the gerrymandering of their districts, but in terms of the inclusion of inmates in all these upstate prisons as part of the population base of the elected officials in those districts, even though the inmates never vote for any of those elected officials. So there is the combination of the structural problems, there's a combination of the gerrymandering that occurs on a regular basis, and then there's the outright voter suppression that increasingly has become a method of assuring that one person, one vote doesn't mean the same thing wherever you are in different parts of the country. That combination of factors means that at the national level, the results do not always represent what the population is. Then you have the issue of most of these countries were former imperial powers. And as former imperial powers, they have within their boundaries large numbers of peoples from their former colonies. The reasons there are so many Algerians, Tunisians, and Moroccans in France is because those were the colonies of the French Empire. The reason there's so many Pakistanis, Indians, and Jamaicans in the United Kingdom is because those were the colonies of the United Kingdom. And the reason there's so many Latin Americans and West Indians in the United States is because those were that was the area where the American Empire was first developed and grew. So what happened is as the Third World came to the West, and increasingly gravitated toward the cities. The cities developed a different, complete identity from the rest of the nation. And then the right-wing politicians use these racial fears of the other to generate votes so that every one of these countries has a major anti-immigrant movement. And it's an anti-immigrant movement against the former colonies, the immigrants from the former colonies. And it continues to justify the sense of superiority to huge sectors of the population. So they play on these social and cultural issues to the rural areas and the exurban areas. So I think that's where they're able to mobilize populist, right-wing populist support. So I think that that partly explains why the cities have gone in a different direction from the rural and exurban areas of these countries.
So let's talk about, you know, what you chronicle in the book. I mean, Bill, how is it that the reverse occurs? In other words, how have these city governments, city mayors, mobilized people at the municipal level and led? I mean, Bill de Blasio's history is also quite remarkable. I didn't know. Well, perhaps that's more a testament to my ignorance than what one knows about Bill de Blasio, but I was very struck by the things that you told us about his past, the different movements he was involved in. So could you say a little about that and why his message seemed to resonate so widely with people in the city?
Well, I think that one of the interesting things that I've found out is that many of the folks who are now in city councils and mayoralties of this progressive movement, which I believe, as I said, came of age in 2013, were themselves the products of grassroots or radical movements of the past, and sometimes the children of former radical activists. And they got to a point in their lives when they finally were able to get elected to office and implement some policies. I mean, de Blasio, you know, it's as I say in the book, his parents were both New Deal Democrats. His mother was more of a socialist than the father was, but they were both very much liberal New Deal Democrats, both targeted by during the McCarthy era witch hunts and made it impossible for them to hold down jobs in government. Both of them with very progressive ideals, which they imbued in their children, and that de Blasio then, his mother, for instance, wrote a book on the Italian resistance during World War II, and detailing the different political battles between the socialists, the communists, and the anarchists in Italy. Now, anybody who bothers to go into the details and the minutia of the differences between the socialist, communists, and anarchists in Italy in the 1940s obviously comes from a radical background. Why would they even take the time to study the tactical and strategic differences? So he comes out of that tradition. But I think there are other folks, like I, for instance, one of the people I feature in the book is a guy by the name of Nick Licata, who I'm sure most people have never heard of. Nick Licata grew up in Ohio in a working class family. He went to Bowling Green University, becomes a member of the Students for a Democratic Society in the late 1960s, an anti-war activist, but eventually decides that SDS is too elitist and too out of touch with ordinary Americans. So he leaves SDS and he ends up going to Seattle, where he joins a radical commune in Seattle. Now, you know, a lot of people joined communes in the 70s around the United States. But Nick Licata stayed in that commune for like 25 years. He got married in the commune. He raised his kids in the commune. He eventually becomes an anti-nuclear activist. He runs for office in the late 1990s in Seattle, and he gets elected, surprisingly, to the city council. He becomes he keeps getting elected and re-elected and re-elected to the Seattle City Council, to the point where he eventually becomes the president of the City Council. And Nick Licata was well-known because he always insisted to start every City Council meeting with a poem by a local Seattle poet. People thought, what the heck are you doing having a poem before discussion of legislation or testimony by this or that person? But he felt that people had to get in touch with their other parts of their psyche before they could discuss legislation. When he's president of the Seattle City Council, the Seattle Supersonics demand a new subsidy to renovate their old arena in Seattle. And Nick Licata, now the president, he says, wait a second. We gave you subsidies and a huge bond issue 20 years ago for this arena, and you still haven't paid back those old bonds. And now you want a new subsidy, and you want more tax-exempt bonds? He says, no, we're not going to give you the tax-exempt bonds. And the Seattle Supersonics said, well, if you don't give us the bonds, we're leaving, and we're going someplace else. And Nick Licata said, go ahead and leave. Not only go ahead and leave, but on your way out the door, pay us back for the old bonds that you never finished paying off from the last subsidy you got. So the Seattle Supersonics left town. They became the Oklahoma City Thunder. Oklahoma City is very glad to have a professional basketball team until they lost Kevin Durant. Now, I'm not sure how they feel now. But Nick Licata became known as the politician who drove the Seattle Supersonics out of Seattle. And he is one of the few elected officials in the entire nation that I know who stood up to a professional basketball team trying to blackmail the citizens of their town for more money for their private profit. And no one is arguing today that Seattle is any worse off as a city because the Supersonics left town. But I think that he is an example of the kinds of progressive elected officials who are now coming to power in these cities and really changing the nature of what I call and other people call the neoliberal model of urban governance in America. De Blasio is in that vein. I mean, I list in the book any number of reforms that have occurred under the de Blasio administration that have meant a significant wealth transfer, an astonishing wealth transfer that no one in my fellow journalists in New York City ever bothered to add up, because everyone talks about data these days and you've got to show the data. So I said, okay, I'll show you the data. I'll show you the data of what has actually happened as a result of the reforms. Rent. There's 860,000 apartments in New York City that are rent regulated by the city of New York. Every year, There's a board of the cities, a rent guidelines board, that tells the landlords, these are privately owned buildings, that tells the landlords how much they may raise the rent to the tenants for the following year. For 40 years prior to de Blasio, the landlords got an average of 3.2% increases every single year. Sometimes it was 7%, sometimes 5, sometimes 1, but the average over all that time was 3.2%. And the first 3 years of the de Blasio administration, after he gained control of the Rent Guidelines Board, the landlords got 1% increase the first year, they got 0 the second year, they got 0 the third year. Basically, 0.33% average over 3 years compared to 3.2% over the last 40 years. You can quantify that. You can get what the average rent is in rent-stabilized apartment, what the tenants would have paid if they got the normal increase versus what they actually did pay. I did the calculations. It comes to $2.1 billion that the landlords of these buildings lost and that the tenants of those buildings gained in not having to pay those historical rent increases. That's a clear wealth transfer that occurred in New York City. There was earned sick time. 1 week, 500,000 workers in New York City could not take a day off from work if their kids got sick or if they got sick because they were low-wage workers and they would be docked pay. Those 500,000 workers all were required to have a week's sick pay. And that works out to about $500 million that went from the restaurant and the small business owners to the pockets of those workers. There's universal pre-K. The signature reform of the de Blasio administration. The first year, 53,000 four-year-olds were given a universal pre-K, the next year 70,000, the next year 70,000. That's 140 and 53, 193,000 children over 3 years got an entire additional year of public education. But more importantly, their parents saved a year of child care. Your average child care cost in New York City is $12,500 a year. If you take off the 2 months of summer when the parents still had to pay their child care, every one of those families saved $10,000 a year. When you do the multiplication, it comes to $1.4 billion that those parents saved. There were wage increases to city workers who had not had a raise in 5 years. So most 3 years, but a significant portion, 5 years. Within 6 months, de Blasio negotiated new labor contracts with all the unions, fair labor contracts, and the wage back pay plus the increases for the future years, total cost $17 billion, right? So altogether, I concluded that in the first 3 years of the de Blasio administration, and then there were a bunch of other smaller reforms, but you're looking at $21 billion. In wealth transfers that occurred in New York City to working families and middle-class families as a direct result of the reforms that were instituted by not only de Blasio, but he was lucky that he had a very progressive city council, that he had other city officials that were elected with him, so he had a coalition that really began to change the direction of city government from trickle down to trickle up. That the way you have a city prosper is you raise the economic level of those at the bottom. There was $15 an hour guaranteed minimum wage for all city workers, eventually translated into $15 an hour at the state level that Governor Cuomo was really forced into supporting, and those are only kicking in now. So the increases at the bottom are only now beginning to take effect as a result of $15 an hour across the board for all workers in New York State was passed recently. So this is a whole new direction in how to govern in cities from the old way that was, let's build stadiums, let's build luxury housing, let's build commercial development, let's subsidize downtown, and to let's raise the economic level of the entire city by raising the level of those at the bottom.
Yeah, so I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, the fact that that Bill de Blasio did this is extraordinary, as you chronicle it in your book, but that he had this community, the council, all these people who were on his side. I mean, to me, it raises a very interesting question because the argument, and you've, of course, spent so much of your reporting life following movements for social justice and activists, and that the question is, well, you know, the role of these people, like Bill de Blasio, is to stay outside of power, not assume power, stay outside and hold it accountable. And then people say, well, because once you come to occupy state power, then you're necessarily compromised by it, right? But what your book suggests, and of course there are several examples like this, that that doesn't, I mean, a lot of people were very critical of Obama because they felt this is exactly the guy who worked as a, you know, in Chicago as a community organizer and so on. But Bill de Blasio's example, as you lay it out, seems to suggest something different.
Well, you know, this is a tough issue because on the one hand, people want change. They want the lives of those around them to be better. And so protest movements arise. Sometimes they become overwhelming in their strength, but movements rise and fall. Right, there's always an ebb and flow to all social movements. Ultimately, the goals of the movement have to be translated into structural changes in the society. Mm. Who's going to do that? Who's going to do that? It's easy to criticize. It's hard to govern. Right. So the issue then becomes the progressive movements eventually split between those who enter government in an attempt to implement the policies of the original movement, and those who feel that, no, I can't go into government because I'll be corrupted, but they still want the change. So then the problem becomes which ones of the elected leaders who believe that they are implementing the goals of the movement that they started with actually effectively make change, and which ones of them end up selling out. You know, it's like, you know, power is an aphrodisiac. You know, you can easily get corrupted. You can easily get deviated. You can easily actually believe you're doing good, but not really doing good. But what's the alternative? To stay on the sidelines all the time criticizing, or to try to develop the creative and innovative ways to actually govern in a just manner? And this is especially true at the local level, because clearly at the state level, at the national level, anybody who dreamed that Barack Obama was going to bring about nirvana in America was sadly mistaken from the start. He would never have gotten to the point he got if he hadn't been properly vetted by all the major interests in the society. But at the local level, it is possible to have creative governance, to be able to affect policies and actually improve people's lives. So I think that that is what's occurring. And, you know, it's occurring right here in Philadelphia. I mean, two of the people that I feature in the book are two of the most progressive political leaders that the city has had in recent years. W. Wilson Good Jr., who may be in the audience, I don't know, I was told he might come, and Helen Gim. Helen Gim, the city councilwoman. Now, I knew Wilson's father very well, because as a reporter for the Philadelphia Daily News, I covered the Good administration right across the hall from his office in the press room and on the second floor of City Hall for many years. But Wilson Good Jr. Wilson Good Sr. was a pioneer in black empowerment, but he was not, I don't think, most people would say, the most progressive of political leaders. His son, however, turned out to be a distinctly progressive voice on the city council and really, effectively, more so than many of the other members of the council, tried to bring a different kind of governance to Philadelphia, and most recently Helen Gim, who comes right out of the social movements of Philadelphia, both parents' movements for public schools, as well as the movement of Chinatown to defend itself from being destroyed, first by Mayor John Street's effort to build a a stadium for the Phillies in Chinatown, and then by Mayor Michael Nutter's efforts to build a casino in Chinatown. And the Chinatown community stood up and fought and defended itself and achieved major and important victories. And now Helen is on the city council. And these are examples of some of the local folks right here in Philadelphia who have a different vision of governance around the neoliberal city. And when I say the neoliberal, it's important to understand that there's always been a growth machine in urban America now for throughout the 20th century that always saw land in the city as the for how much money can it generate, you know, the maximum amount of money from urban land. Whereas those who espouse the use method of land and city says, how can this land be used to benefit the residents? Public parks, public schools, public commons. How do you maintain land for the use of the people, not for the benefit of the developers and the financiers and those who want to make the most money out of it? And the growth machine has had adherence in both the Democratic and the Republican parties, not a partisan political thing. But the new movement that has arisen in the last 10 to 15 years is challenging the old methods of the growth machine and is seeking to say that cities should be governed for the benefit of the majority of the people. And that's the key issue, I think, that this new wave of progressive political officials is now trying to implement.
Well, before we open the floor for questions, Juan, one last point. I mean, you've said of the people that you talk about, they've come into power. They have, in some cases, like in Bill de Blasio's case, a city council that's sympathetic and progressive. But you also show in your book the extent to which there's opposition from the real estate elite, the financial elite in the city. So explain how that works and what the effect of that is.
Well, the effect is that there's a constant struggle. And one of the biggest issues right now, and I think the burning issue in all of urban America, is where will the people live? As I document in the book, as far back as 1968, President Lyndon Johnson created two major national commissions on the cities in 1968. The Kerner Commission, which is a commission on civil disorders. The other was the Johnson Commission of Senator Paul Johnson, who looked at the problems of housing in the cities. And what the Johnson Commission concluded in 1968 was that America had a critical housing shortage. The cities of America had a critical housing shortage. And the Johnson Committee specifically said that the private sector left to itself will never build low-cost housing. Never. Because why would you as a developer build the same structure with the same plumbing system and electrical system, and all you do is put on some granite countertops and put a doorman in the front, and you can sell it as a luxury apartment rather than low-cost housing, right? So there's no incentive for the private sector to ever build low-cost housing. So back in 1968, the Johnson Commission said only government intervention will assure an end to the critical housing shortage in America. That was 1968. A few years later, Nixon comes into office, and the federal government begins to get out of the housing business. And by the time Reagan came into office, they were destroying public housing, low-cost housing. So we have had a housing crisis in America for more than 50 years, and it has continued to grow worse. That's why we have the homeless problem. That's why we have the affordability problem. Right now in New York City, one-third of all the renters in New York City pay more than 50% of their income in rent. One-third, right? That means one-third of the renters in New York City are working to pay the landlord. That's all they do, you know? And so, and it's same thing is true in Seattle and Chicago and Los Angeles and Boston and all of these cities in San Francisco. There's a housing crisis. The federal and state governments have abandoned the need for low-cost housing. Now the city leaders are trying to tackle it, but they don't have the resources, so they come up with this idea, well, we'll offer the developers height for affordability. We'll rezone, we'll push the buildings higher, and you'll maybe give us 25 or 30% mandatory housing, affordable housing, but the affordability is not deep enough for the poorest folks. The developers will always get a better deal than they really deserve. And so the critical issue for all of these progressive mayors and councils is how do you build affordable housing in the absence of any federal and state intervention? And if they don't answer that question, the cities are going to look completely different in another 20, 30 years than what they do now. All the poor are going to be pushed out into the suburbs, into the outer rings, just like they are were in Europe after World War II. You know, Europe, in one sense, because of all the bombings that occurred, got the opportunity to rebuild its cities. And what did they do? They pushed all the poor way out. Right? The United States never had the bombings, the destruction of the inner cities, so it has taken longer for the United States to follow the European example and push the poor out. But it's being done. And the question is, what's government's role in the in that issue of saving cities, not just for the wealthy, but for middle class and working class families?
Thank you, Juan. So now we'd like to open the floor to questions. Just raise your hand. I'll call on you. And if I may ask that you ask a question, please. The person at the...
There's a lot of poverty in those rural areas and so forth as well. And the cities are up against state legislatures that have the purse and the national government that has the purse. You know, if you want to fund the real equality sort of, you know, measures, you've got to get broader coalitions that reach out into the hinterland. Any thoughts about that? How to go about that? How these urban movements might connect?
Well, I think one of the points I make in the book is that the world is becoming increasingly urbanized. Right? About 50% of all the world's people live in cities today. In another 20 years, it'll be 70%. More and more people are leaving the countryside and moving to the cities. You know, I don't care where you go, in any state in the union, the populations continue to gravitate toward the big cities. So really the question of governing the cities is an issue of how the planet will be governed in the future. Now, yes, the levers of state and federal governments in many of these places are still in what I would call retrograde or regressive, under retrograde or regressive control. However, it's not as if nothing can be done in cities. Cities do have leverage on sustainable development. You know, many more cities are now going into developing bike lanes and developing ways to control their emissions. They have. When it comes to sustainable development, cities have power. When it comes to police accountability, cities have power within their own jurisdictions. When it comes to sanctuary cities, which I believe the immigration issue is now basically a battle in the cities versus the states and the national governments. You know, one of the points I'm making, some of you are old enough to know this, others not. In the 50s, there was a major battle between the federal government and the states and the local governments over the issue of integration. President Eisenhower sent in federal troops into Little Rock, Arkansas, to force the integration of Central High School in Little Rock after the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, because all the public officials in Arkansas refused to integrate their schools. President Kennedy sent 2,000 federal marshals into Oxford, Mississippi in 1962 because the state of Mississippi and the local officials in Oxford were refusing to integrate the University of Mississippi. They stayed for 2 years occupying the city of Oxford. There were pitched battles between the federal marshals, gun battles between the federal marshals and the forces of segregation. Back then, the confrontation was between an enlightened and progressive federal government and a reactionary and regressive local government. Today, it is reversed. The federal government represents reaction and regression. The local cities and one state, California, represent progress. For those of you who did not hear, 2 weeks ago, California declared the entire state a sanctuary state. So California And all of the major cities in America are going one way. And the other states and the federal governments are going in a different direction. And there is a looming confrontation. I believe that it will be first manifested in the state of Texas, because the state of Texas recently passed a law that threatens to lock up any public official who refuses to cooperate with immigration on deportation and handing over of undocumented immigrants. Every mayor of all the major cities in Texas, Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, Austin, El Paso, Brownsville, they've all on record opposed to this. Every police chief in all those cities says you're making our ability to fight crime more difficult because undocumented immigrants will not report crimes to the police. They will refuse to be witnesses in trials. They won't report domestic abuse incidents for fear of being deported. So the police chiefs, many of the sheriffs, and the mayors have all said they're opposed to this law. The state says we're going to lock you up if you don't implement the law. It was supposed to begin on September 1. It's tied up in the courts right now. It'll go to the Supreme Court. By early 2018, the Supreme Court, given the current makeup of the Supreme Court, will likely back up the state legislature of Texas. At that point, you may see in America mayors and police chiefs being arrested for refusing to obey the law in Texas over sanctuary cities. I believe you do not have to have a majority to force the society to deal with an issue. Sometimes you don't have the majority. But if you believe you're right, you stand up for what you believe in, and then you create a teaching moment, as we say in academia. You create a teaching moment where the confrontation becomes so strong that everybody has to address it one way or another. So I think that's where we're headed. We're headed toward direct confrontations between the cities and the federal and the state government. And that's why I believe that these mayors and these council members, and perfect as they may be, and in almost every city I've been in, the people in the local area have more criticism of their local progressive officials than anyone else, because they know them better. And as imperfect as they may be, they represent the best hope to force the society in a different direction. So you have to basically criticize their mistakes, pressure them where they're going wrong, but support them in their effort to stand up for the things that you believe are right.
Juan, I assume from your answer, we're fighting these battles, I'm sure that Mike DeVerdinas can tell you about right here in Philadelphia, but I'm assuming again from the response that you gave in this era of the carnival barker and the right-wing sideshow, that you're pretty optimistic about how this is going to turn out. In other words, this battle between sort of the local folks and the people in the state government or federal government, I wish I could have that optimism, but it sounds like you have it. Is that accurate?
I do have the optimism because I've been to these cities and I see the amazing thing that young people and not so young people, but most of them are young people, are doing. I'll give you an example, Austin, Texas. Austin, Texas, there's a young kid by the name of Gregorio Casar who was elected to the youngest person ever elected to the Austin City Council at the age of 25. He's now become a leading figure in the fight over sanctuary cities. He's already been arrested a couple of times, but he says, I am going to jail rather than give in to this decision by our state legislature. And he's hardened the backbone of many of the other members of the city council. Gregorio Casar, 10 years ago, was a kid in the immigration protests of 2006 when his parents took him on to the immigration protests. And now he is like a major political leader in Austin, or Helen Gim here, or Lisa Herbold in Seattle. There are all of these young folks who are now in council seats, but increasingly, as I said, these mayors that are really challenging the status quo, and I think that they represent the future. Right, the people who are now this, I'll give you another example. Wes Bellamy, and this is an example of where you do not need even a majority to affect change. Wes Bellamy is an African-American who got elected to the city council of Charlottesville, Virginia, a couple of years ago. Not the first African-American, the only African-American now on the city council. And as soon as he got elected, he started raising questions about the statue of Robert E. Lee in downtown Charlottesville. He said, I want that statue removed. And the council majority said, no way. We're not going to do that. That's going to create a furor in this state if we take down the statue of Robert E. Lee. So then Bellamy was like tactical. And he said, okay, you don't want to give me the statue? I want a reparations package for the black community. Right? I want a fund established to provide scholarships and job training and all this stuff for the black community. And when I heard of that, I said, wow, that's a great idea, because everyone's talking about reparations at the national level, which is definitely not going to happen with this Congress, or, you know, Congress is into the foreseeable future. But you could start reparations packages at the local level. You could start a movement of reparations packages at the local level, especially in cities where there are large African-American populations. So the city council was so desperate to stop Wes Bellamy that they gave him a package. They called it an equity fund. And they gave him $8 or $10 million for scholarships and job training and all this other stuff. And he was just one person. Then, a few months later, a couple of the council members changed their minds, right? Because they're hearing all the Confederate flag stuff going on all around the country. They figured, oh, maybe it's not a good idea to keep standing up for this Robert E. Lee statue. So they agreed to take the statue down. And that's when the furor started in Charlottesville, because then the Klan got involved, and then the marches started, and then of course Charlottesville became a national issue. It became a teaching moment in America, right? For even Trump got involved, and everyone got involved over Charlottesville. It started with one African American on the city council. That's all it took, who stood up and said, "I want change. I'm not going to accept the status quo." And he's young, he's like in his 30s. So I'm saying, you don't need a majority. You just need to believe that justice must be served, you know, that wrongs must be righted. And if you stick to it, you can force change. You can make change. But you first have to believe you can do it. If you don't believe you can do it, it'll never happen.
I'm not sure it's that much of a question, but I'll see. First, I disagree with your citation of good council people in Philadelphia. You have your opinion, I have mine. I disagree with you. You mentioned that you need to initiate policies that benefit the majority of the city. I think it's given that, at least in Philadelphia, at this point, blacks are the majority of the city. Yet, and still, they've had the policy of, I'm concerned about tax rebates, which have been used, and I think they're still being used, to, as far as I'm concerned, to exterminate blacks in the city.
I'm sorry, you said tax rebates? I'm not familiar with...
Mm-hmm. What do you call...
Oh, yeah, tax abatements on new construction. Absolutely. I agree with you that has been a problem throughout the cities for decades, but that is a politics, that's an old politics that I believe that many of the progressive people who are getting elected now are seeking to change, right? They're seeking to get rid of those tax abatements in areas, especially in areas where development would occur anyway, and you really don't need particular tax abatements because they're already valuable areas that development would occur anyway. It's just extra profit for the people who build that housing. There's a big battle going on in New York City right now because the development interests will tell you you have to have these incentives. That's why I gave the example of Nick Licata in Seattle with the sports teams, because the sports teams are mega tax incentives for many cities. But it happens with luxury housing, it happens with commercial development downtown, and the issue is to redirect the resources of the city into the neighborhoods. And I think that for the most part, and I'm not gonna say every one of these progressive officials is 100% on this, because they're not, right? But for the most part, their trend is to reduce these kinds of tax abatements for downtown development, and to use the power of local government to incentivize the development of neighborhoods rather than downtown.
Well, please join me in thanking Juan for the evening, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.